What's the difference between a rat and a hamster? How about a dog and a coyote? While there are certainly biological differences, to a large extent, the difference lies in human psychology, in whether we consider the animal to be a pet or a pest. While we're happy to have certain creatures in our homes and happy to let others live in the wilderness, those wild animals who enter human spaces uninvited can cause us fear, anger, or revulsion. This is the subject of the new book, Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains, by Bethany Brookshire. Bethany is an award-winning science writer, a podcast host, and a former MIT Knight Science Journalism Fellow. Her work has been published in outlets including The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Scientific American, and Science News. Here she is to share five of her big ideas.
Hi, I'm Bethany Brookshire. I'm a former scientist turned science journalist, and I'm fixated on how people interact with the animals and environments around them. The outcome of my obsession is my first book, Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains. Today, I'm sharing with you five of the biggest insights that I learned as I wrote this book. Insight number one: that we call a pest is an animal's success. Many of us who live in the West have become very separated from the wildlife around us. When that separation happens, we start to divide up the animals we see into two groups: the ones we see rarely and the ones we see too much. The ones we see rarely are the exciting animals, the pandas and tigers and wolves and elephants, the animals we will travel and pay a lot of money to see. We're always thrilled to see them, and to us, they are the epitome of wildness. But the animals we see too much, the rats and pigeons and mice, we call pests, annoyances, not where they belong. But in fact, these animals are wildlife too, and they are wildly successful. Rats, pigeons, and mice now persist on every continent but Antarctica. They have succeeded because they tag along with us. Take, for example, mice. Archaeologists have found tiny mouse teeth associated with some of the earliest human dwellings that we know of. People had not yet started farming, but they had started living in one place for seasons of the year, and mice came scuttling in. We have had house mice since we have had houses. And by piggybacking on our spread, mice have spread too, to almost every corner of the world. Pigeons also spread around the world because we brought them there, but this time we brought them on purpose. Pigeons are especially useful because they go out every day and feed themselves, and come back to exactly where they started. Humans domesticated the pigeon around 5,000 years ago, and used the birds as messengers, sources of fertilizer, and of course, tasty pigeon pie. Domestication is another form of animal success. Domesticated pigeons produce more pigeons, and that is a perfectly successful strategy. But then, we lost our use for the pigeon. We have telephones and chemical fertilizers and chicken. We don't need pigeons anymore. So we let them go. But pigeons kept on doing what they'd always done: going away, eating, coming home, and making more pigeons. And now, we hate them for the very things that we loved about them. We hate their success. People spend a lot of time bewailing what we do to animals, and we do many terrible things. We have driven numerous species to extinction, but when animals succeed, and succeed around us, we're suddenly a lot less excited. We want animals to thrive. Of course we do. We just don't want it to cause us any inconvenience. Insight number two: a pest is often of our own making. Many times, when we confront an animal causing us annoyance or harm, we are utterly shocked. How could this happen? Who could possibly have predicted this? Well, we could. Often, the animals we call pests are where they are because of something we have done. Maybe we planted a beautiful field of grain and birds found it. Maybe we brought cats, obligate carnivores, and dropped them on islands where no animal had ever seen a predator. Or maybe we shipped over giant poisonous toads to Australia. That is, in fact, what happened with the cane toad. In the 1930s, farmers in Australia were trying to grow sugarcane, but were suffering from cane beetles, whose larvae ate away at the roots. So they imported cane toads. These toads have been shown to eat a lot of things, and some of those things were cane beetles. Here is where our ignorance comes in. If scientists had been doing their due diligence, they would have studied the toads. They would have looked at their behavior patterns, what they ate in the wild, and what ate them. They would have checked to see how well they might do in an environment like Australia, and whether sugarcane plantations with toads did better than those without. Scientists did none of those things. Instead, they just bred up the toads and released them. It turns out that cane toads do sometimes eat cane beetles, but the larvae are in the soil and cane toads don't dig. The beetles have wings, and cane toads don't fly. Cane toads didn't solve the cane beetle problem. But they immediately caused a problem of their own. The toads have poisonous pads on their shoulders. The native predators of Australia would gulp down a tasty toad snack and quickly find out it was their last meal. In some areas, up to 90% of local predators die as cane toads arrive. Scientists have been unable to stop the cane toad advance across Australia. Cane toads are now one of the many pests loathed on that continent. When we see an animal and declare it a pest, what we are often seeing is the result of our own ignorance. In our efforts to make our own lives better, we often fail to think about how our actions might impact the environments around us. We bring cats to take care of mice and don't think about the birds cats also love to eat. We plant fields full of grain and forget that other animals also find our food delicious. In that way, it's sometimes our own nearsightedness that creates the animals we call pests. Insight number 3. Our beliefs can create pests and influence how we control them. Lots of people adore cats. I know I do. I've got 2. But outdoor cats, whether feral, stray, or even owned, kill billions of birds per year and are thought to be responsible for the extinction of at least 63 species. Cuddly Fluffy in the sheets and Killer in the streets. When people hear about this, of course, they want to protect birds and small mammals and reptiles. But does that mean killing the cats? This is where our beliefs come in. Our beliefs about cats mean that, even though they cause harm, we have a tough time calling them a pest. We also don't want to treat them like pests. A rat on an island gets greeted with poison and traps. A cat on an island? Some people might offer poison and traps. Others might be horrified and want the cats adopted. But what's the difference, really? We brought the rats, and we brought the cats. Both the cats and the rats are causing harm to the animals that live there. The difference is entirely about what we believe. Social scientists have shown that views about cats in particular are the result of culture. People who love cats view all cats, even feral ones, as homeless pets, pets with a right to roam. Conservationists, on the other hand, view outdoor cats as one of many invasive species, species that need to be gotten rid of, including by killing them. These are different cultures, different ways of looking at one animal in the world. But because those two different cultures exist, and often they exist in the same place, actually stopping cats from killing wildlife becomes a lot harder. Everyone can agree that the world needs fewer cats living as strays and ferals, yes. But when no one can agree whether the cats should be all trapped or adopted, or trapped and killed, suddenly our beliefs about pests get in the way of acting to prevent their harms. Insight number 4. Pests challenge our power. In my research, I found that our fearful and often violent responses to pests come down to power. Many of us in the West feel that we dominate our ecosystems, either through being the pinnacle of evolution or through divine right. Then, when animals come into environments we think we control, we suddenly realize that we're vulnerable. We feel powerless, and our first response is often anger and violence. A good example of this is coyotes living in urban environments. You'd think that when people move to the countryside or to the suburbs, they'd want to see wildlife, right? Of course they want to live closer to nature. It's why they got out of the city. But when people do see or hear about a coyote in their neighborhood, they suddenly don't seem so happy to hear about the wildlife in their backyard. They fear for their pets or for their children, and often they want to call someone and have that coyote removed. That reaction is because coyotes challenge the power we want to feel in our environments. We want to feel close to nature, but we want that nature to be tame. We want it to be unable to hurt us or anything we care about. Any plant that might defend itself, like poison ivy, is a weed. And any animal that might harm what we value is a pest. When we respond to those interlopers, that response reinforces our desire to be the top dog. We rip out weeds, we poison rats, we trap and shoot coyotes. What I find especially fascinating is how much we feel we deserve to do this, that we deserve to be in charge in our environments, Not only that, we deserve to live in exactly the way we want and should never change our behavior for another species. In fact, not every culture feels this way. I was very lucky to be able to learn from many indigenous people for this book, and in many cases, they don't think of themselves as dominant in an ecosystem. Instead of giving themselves all the credit and animals none, they give animals more and themselves a little less. Yes, humans have skills and intelligence and abilities, but other animals, like coyotes, do as well. They deserve respect and understanding just like people do. And when animals began to cause people problems, many indigenous people I spoke to didn't just trap and shoot their way out. They asked why. Why is that animal there? What is the animal doing? And how can I change what I do to solve this problem? Yes, coyotes do challenge our feeling of power and control over our neighborhoods. They make us feel vulnerable. But we don't have to solve the problem by increasing our iron grip with traps. We could do it by keeping pets inside, by hazing coyotes correctly to make sure they stay cautious of humans, and by making sure they do not get fed on human food. We could change our own behavior and accept that our power over the landscape isn't absolute. Insight number 5. We can make pests disappear. All it requires is a change in perspective. When we label something a pest, we declare that it has no value, that it's in our way. If we continue to think of ourselves as dominating our environments, we will always find pests, animals that intrude, that we need to get rid of. This traps us in an offensive war against the pest, one where we attack endlessly and never seem to win. If we decided to think a little differently, though, we could make pests disappear. As I mentioned earlier, there are many cultures around the world that see themselves as part of an ecosystem, not in charge of one. Those cultures are right. Evolution has no pinnacles, and we've never been separate from the environments we live in. Take, for example, black bears and the Kitisew Haihai in the Great Bear Rainforest in British Columbia. I got to learn from one of the chief counselors of the Kitisew Haihai about what they did about bears. A few years ago, bears had started coming into the community, interested in the leavings from the fish cannery and the fruit trees and trash on people's property. Eventually, the village called the government. But the government's only legal response in that situation was to kill the bear. The village was horrified. They didn't want the bears killed. Bears are very important to the Kitisew Haihai in their culture and stories. So the village said they would handle this bear issue on their own, thanks. They did not try to change the bears. They changed themselves. The cannery is far away from people. The villagers all got bear-resistant trash cans, and they took down every fruit tree in the village so bears would have no reason to come around. And the bears stopped coming, because the villagers didn't just respond like the bears were interlopers. They responded with knowledge and understanding. They felt the bears had value, and they acted like it. If we saw ourselves as part of an ecosystem, we would find more reasons to learn about the animals in our midst, why they appear where they do, and how to prevent their impacts. Knowing that every animal around us had value would make our prevention more thoughtful, more defensive, and less deadly. Thank you for listening to this book bite. I hope you enjoy reading Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains.
Thank you, Bethany. That was Bethany Brookshire with 5 big ideas from Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains. If you want to learn more about one type of animal that's been considered a pest, a pet, and even a god, check out our book bite for Birds and Us, a 12,000-year history from cave art to conservation. I'm Michael Kovnet. Thanks for listening.